Welcome back to the Feminist Book Club podcast, a show for dangerous, well-read women. Each week, we explore literature and media through a feminist lens as one small way to reclaim our time, our books, and our stories. Let's get started. Hi, everyone. Welcome back. I'm sitting down with Marjan Kamali. Marjan is the author of the novels The Stationery Shop and Together Tea. Born in Turkey to Iranian parents, she's lived in seven countries across five continents. Her first novel was a Massachusetts Book Award finalist, translated into several languages and adapted for the stage. It follows a mother and daughter as they embark on a return journey to Iran. Her second novel, which we'll be discussing today, is The Stationery Shop. Hailed by the Wall Street Journal as a moving tale of lost love, it was one of Newsweek's best summer reads and one of NPR's best books of 2019. Welcome, Marjan.
Thank you for having me.
I can't wait to talk about this story some more, but I ask everyone right off the bat, what is your definition of feminism?
That's a really good question. And I think for me, the definition of feminism is the ability to be myself. I think there's so many definitions of feminism out there and people fight about them and argue about them. But for me, to be able to be myself is the most empowering thing in the world, and that's harder to achieve than it would seem.
Why do you think that?
Because I think even if you say I'm a feminist, or even if you try and sort of define yourself that way, you're going to get pushback. Well, you're not, because you did this and this. You know, maybe you are too girly girl in the things you like to buy. You know, there's always judgment. So I think the true definition of being a feminist is to be yourself without apology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, unapologetic women and people, human beings, are my favorite kind of humans. So can you give us a brief synopsis of The Stationery Shop, just so all of our listeners who haven't read it yet, which they should, are all on the same page moving forward?
Yes. So The Stationery Shop is a love story. It's a story about two teenagers who meet when they're 17 in a stationery shop in 1953. And amidst the papers and inkwells and fountain pens, they find a kind of refuge in that shop, and they fall madly in love the way you only can when you're young. They slip briskly, as F. Scott Fitzgerald says, into this intimacy from which they never recover. I love that quote. And then they're engaged to be married. But even though the country at that time is blossoming with a great art scene and cinema and theater and tango dances and all kinds of publishing, there's also a huge sort of growing division politically in the country. And the country is divided between pro-Shah monarchists and the pro-prime minister, sort of nationalists and the communists. There's a huge coup d'etat in the country, and they get separated and they don't see each other again. And Roya just sort of resigns herself, even though she tries very hard to find her fiance, and she moves to the US and she goes to college in California and marries a man from New England and has a whole other life there. But she's always haunted by the question of what happened to this first love. And then 60 years later in Massachusetts, they reunite when they're 77. So it's the story of finding the answers as much as possible to the questions of what happened to that first love.
I've seen this book compared a lot to Nicholas Sparks' The Notebook. Why do you think it gets that comparison so much?
I think it's because, I guess the common thing it has with The Notebook is that it follows these two characters who sort of have this intense attraction for each other when they're very young. And then it follows them through to their old age. There's so much it doesn't have in common with The Notebook. But I would say the theme that I think makes people make the connection is that not being able to let go of this first love that makes such an imprint on your mind.
I ask that because I independently, before reading some of the reviews, thought this is really similar to The Notebook. And why do I think that? And also, I hate The Notebook, but I love this book. So what is it about this? And I think there's the similarities, like you said, are there. And one of the things that I do find similar are the female protagonists. Mm-hmm. I forget Rachel McAdams' character in The Notebook. I forget her name.
Yeah, I know. I always call her Rachel McAdams.
I know.
That is not her name.
She's feisty. She's got a lot of energy. She is kind of a manic pixie dream girl character in some ways in the 50s. Mm-hmm. But Roya, I would say, is also feisty and a little precocious, but in a very different way. And we were talking a little bit before we started recording that your characters are very feminist, especially the females, in their own ways, in their own context. Can you talk a little bit about the female characters and the relation to feminism?
Yes. I agree with you that Roya, the main character, is, in my opinion, a feminist. You are right. She is feisty, especially when, you know, we meet her as a teenager. She's 17. She loves reading, she loves poetry. She's being encouraged by her father and her mother to sort of achieve educational success at a time when a lot of young women in Iran were not encouraged to do so. But she has her own desires and drive. And in a way, if you think about her journey, she takes a very independent route. She's one of the first women in Iran to go overseas for college, to go to the US. That was the first generation then in the early 50s. And there were programs in US universities and colleges that invited women from Iran to study. But more than just those basic things that you might associate with feminism, like, oh, she's strong and she's pursuing her education and a career and all that, I think there's a quiet strength in Roya, which can be often overlooked and dismissed as more akin to traditional female characteristics, but I don't think it should be discounted. She may not be as vocal as her younger sister, Zari, who has her own level of precociousness and is very sort of lively and loud, but she has this quiet, persistent strength. And if you think about the course of her life, which as a novelist, I have the privilege of pursuing the course of her life, I think she persists and is patient and eventually comes to a deep understanding of certain events and losses in her life. And I associate that with feminism. You don't need to necessarily be loud or vocal. You just have to be true to yourself and stand up for yourself. And she does.
And she's not the only character who has, I love that, this quiet strength that, and this freedom of the self, I think is what I want to say. Because in 1953 Tehran, women's independence was not nearly what it was here in the US, even though it was limited here in the US as well. And you mentioned Zari, but what are some of the other characters that you'd like to talk about?
I think another character that I get asked about a lot is the quote-unquote mother-in-law in the story. She's always referred to that way, even though if you think about it, Roya and Behnam don't actually marry. This is not a spoiler. You know that from the first chapter. But Behnam's mom, so basically Roya's first love's mother, a very complicated woman, Mrs. Aslan. And she is a character who has a mental illness. She, when you first meet her, she seems sort of stereotypically nasty and mean and demeans Roya. And it's that archetype of a mother-in-law or, you know, future possible mother-in-law. But I really wanted to show her backstory and her adolescence and the things that shaped her into making her who she is. And even though she's an incredibly flawed woman who creates a lot of problems for many a character in the book, to me, she's a feminist because she is, unlike Roya, she is born to a lower class family, a quote unquote lower class. You know, she's born into a poor family. And her entire life, she has to fight this stigma associated with that. And she has to fight for her space in society. She has to fight for status. She experiences intense trauma in a chapter in the book, which I won't go into detail because it is a spoiler, but the way she handles it is not ideal, but she's doing the best she can with what she's got. And exactly. She's shaped by those events.
Yeah. I love all of these little subplots and tendrils we get to follow back to the 30s and into the future. And it is just absolutely riveting. I mean, so personally, I read this on a flight. And I finished it probably 20 minutes before we landed, and I don't cry. I'm not a crier when it comes to books. I could count on one hand the amount of times a book has made me cry, and I was a sobbing mess. I was a mess. There was not enough tissue paper on the plane for me. And I realized that everybody around me must think I'm like sick as a dog because I'm blowing my nose so disgustingly. So thank you for that experience.
You're not alone though. You're not the first person who I've heard read it on a flight and sobbed incessantly and made everybody else completely worried.
I know. Everybody must have been so uncomfortable.
Yes. Because Whitney Scherer, who blurbed the book, she read it on a flight and she told me that she was sobbing incessantly and the guy next to her was truly concerned about her. So I know, I kind of feel bad that people are crying, but then again, that means I've done my job.
It's so cathartic. What do you think it is about this love story that is touching people so deeply?
Thank you for saying that. I have received emails, I've received messages from women saying, because of this book, I'm now going to write a letter to JT. You know, I think it's striking a chord. And honestly, I think that many people can identify with the loss of a first love. But in addition to that, I think we all have in our minds or in our hearts a person in our lives with whom we have some unfinished business, with whom there was no closure, whether it's a romantic person, you know, a romantic partner from the past, or even a friend or family member. And what Roya gets is something many, many, many of us never get, which is the ability to see this person again decades later and to truly have closure with them and to have this sense of healing. And I think that's why people are crying. Like you said, it's kind of cathartic because after everything they go through, and she goes through a heck of a lot, right? We know. After everything she goes through, I do think it is healing to have at the end of her life this reconnection, despite how it turns out. It's not, you know, picture perfect happy ending by any means. But the fact that she could have this reconnection is something I think many people yearn for.
Yeah.
And they can identify with her need for it.
I think you're right. It is not a happy ending, but it is a satisfying ending because of that closure. Yeah, that's beautiful. Mm-hmm. One of the things that's really lovely about this book that it's not typical, especially in really popular fiction, is that our main character is an older woman. Yes, we meet her. We go back to when she's 17, but she is older throughout most of the story. What do you think are the benefits of writing about an older woman? Yeah, and in terms of her role in the book.
The truth is, I got some pushback about her being older. I'll tell you what, we don't like to see older women on the page, on the stage, on the screen. There was resistance. And I was told by early readers and, you know, people who were reading it in the publishing industry that she needed to be young more frequently, meaning the 1953 scenes when she was 17 needed to be longer and greater in number. And I really had to fight to keep old Roya on the page. In the end, you know, there's a nice balance, I think. I, as a novelist, I love writing older characters because it allows me to have a perspective. I get to enter their heads at a time in their lives when they have more knowledge about the events that have shaped them and hopefully some more wisdom. And I think it's a privilege to be in that position. We tend to denigrate older people in our society, especially older women, and act as if they're these silly biddies who are cute. We can pat them on the head and like kind of chuckle with them. They're just these like harmless little tiny women, usually in the stereotype. And for me, it is the absolute opposite. Older women are mountains of strength. They're who I look up to. And the perspective that age can give you is worth everything else that you lose as you age. And as we know, you do lose quite a bit just in other areas. But Roya was a pleasure for me to write as an older woman. And I wish we had in our, you know, representation of women, more older women, as opposed to just writing about women or, you know, making movies about women when they're young and sexy.
Yeah. And I mean, Roya's kind of sexy too in her own way.
Yeah. And that was something I did intentionally because you don't stop being sexy, at least not the women I know. Mm-hmm. And you don't need to retire any part of you if you don't want to. And that is the actual truth. The women I know in their 70s are still quite vibrant and sexy and in the thick of things, in romantic relationships, having these kinds of muddles, it's not like life stops just because you're older. And you know, that's this fallacy we have of making women into these cute cartoon characters when they're older.
Yeah.
They could be further from the truth. And I really wanted to have scenes in an assisted living center.
Yeah.
With older men and women.
Yeah. So we meet Bauman at the end, or throughout we meet him while he's in assisted living. Yes. Why were you so drawn to that?
Well, I'll tell you what happened, actually. When my first book came out about 6 years ago, I did a lot of book events for it. And I visited a book club. And at the end, one woman said, "Will you come to where I work and read for the residents?" And she worked at an assisted living center. And I went there. And when I was reading, there was an elderly man in a wheelchair. And he kept saying things throughout the event. He kept saying things like, "I met the Prince of Spain. I traveled with Charles de Gaulle." He kept going on and on, and everybody else kept shushing him and dismissing him. People were a little bit embarrassed, but I just asked him his name. And then when I went home for Thanksgiving, my dad asked me how the book events were. And I mentioned this man's name only because it was an Iranian name, and my dad thinks he knows every Iranian American. When I mentioned him, my dad said, "Oh, he was one of our most decorated dignitaries. He met the Prince of Spain. He traveled with Charles de Gaulle." And I just sat there and I realized everything he had been saying was actually true.
Wow.
And I couldn't believe it. And I remember just sitting there thinking, what does it mean to be an elderly person, man or woman, in an assisted living center with this past that nobody believes, or they believe it and they just don't care?
Yeah.
And that was the kernel for the book. And I based the scenes in the assisted living center literally on the Duxbury Senior Center. And my clever disguise for it was Duxton. But it's the Duxbury Senior Center. And funny story, I went back there a month ago and I read from the stationery shop and I read to the residents again. And they all know that so much of those scenes were inspired by them and where they live. But that gentleman has since passed away.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. But he, you know, just his, it's not his story by any means, but that idea of being older and just having people dismiss you when you have so much to offer is what inspired me to write about them in their old age.
That is so magnificent. Wow. I'm really touched by that.
Yeah. It's just been amazing. And I was touched when I went back, to be honest with you, because it was like coming full circle. And I literally read the scene where Roya and, you know, she's taken by Walter to the Duxton Senior Center. And they were all sitting there and they're all listening. And I said to them, "You guys, that's here." You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It was a nice connection.
Wow. I want to talk a little bit about Iran and the history of Iran, because Do you consider this a historical fiction?
Yeah, I do, because it contains a huge political event that happened in 1953 that affected history all over the world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So can you share what the event was and why this one in particular? There have been several revolutions in Iran in recent history. Why this one in particular is the one that you wanted to write about?
Yes. So everybody in my generation, at least, remembers, you know, even if they experienced it as small children, 1979, because that was the revolution in our current consciousness. That was the one that brought about the current regime. That was the one that brought about the downfall of the Shah. And I wrote about that in my first book, In Together Tea. And it's the revolution that changed my life, made it upside down. But I realized as I obsessed about 1979 that my parents would just look at us and say, "Yeah, you don't know about 1953. You know, you think this is a big deal? You don't know about 1953. So I'd always heard that, and I wanted to learn more about the coup d'etat of 1953 So I centered the scenes when Roy and Bahman are young in the summer of 1953 in Tehran. And the coup that occurred in Iran on August 19th, 1953, I say this without exaggeration, changed the trajectory of that country forever. And I would argue changed the region. And let me go there, changed the world, because now we have, as a result, we got the Shah becoming more entrenched. Then we got the 1979 revolution and kind of the mess we have all over today. And it was so, in my opinion, tragic. It was done with the help of the UK and the US, and the intentions were not necessarily noble, but I don't think anyone could have predicted the fallout from overthrowing this prime minister who was democratically elected and beloved by many, not all. He certainly had his enemies and he had his flaws too, but I just created this cascade of events. And you know what? That's how life is. One event leads to another, leads to another. And one of the epigraphs I have in the book is there's nothing new in the world except the history you do not know, which was said by Harry Truman. And I think it applies to politics and to personal history too.
I have a lot of avenues I want to go down in terms of the political and historical backdrop of this. But I think for a lot of, especially American readers, we have this, I guess, stereotype of what it must have been like for women in the Middle East. And I don't think the stereotype is correct. Can you talk a little bit about Iranian women, you know, before and after the revolution, before and after the 70s revolution, and now?
Sure. You know, the biggest stereotype I think we have about women in the Middle East is that we think there is such a thing as women in the Middle East.
That's so brilliant.
Yeah, because it's not monolithic. Like, women in the Middle East and the freedoms they have and the rights they have is very country specific. So the rights a woman has in Saudi Arabia is markedly different than the rights a woman has in Iran or in Morocco. You know, so we have this kind of just mistaken assumption that you can even categorize them together. But aside from that, even if you go and you become country specific about it, there's this view that women in the Middle East, but, you know, in any country there, are submissive and oppressed and victims. And I think there's a difference between recognizing that women, and I'll talk about Iran specifically, there's a difference between recognizing that women in Iran lack legal rights that would make them more equal with men under the eyes of the law. There's a difference between that and saying that they are victims. Because if you meet an Iranian woman, by and large, you are not going to meet somebody meek or somebody submissive. And if, again, you can't generalize an entire country, but every Iranian woman I have ever met is pretty vocal. The people advocating for the biggest changes in Iran for the entire society are women. They're fighting. They are strong. And that's why my biggest pet peeve is when people think that women from those cultures are submissive. It's just not true. Are you going to find some submissive women? Yes, but you would find them anywhere. But they are perhaps living in an oppressive society, but they're always standing up. And I just find them to be incredibly strong. So, yeah.
So rethink those stereotypes, people.
Yeah. Rethink them. They're just not true. Also, the view people have, even of their specific rights, is not necessarily accurate. You know, if someone says to me, oh, could women drive? I'm like, oh, please stop. One country where women can't drive, and that's Saudi Arabia. Or just all these myths about genital, like, surgeries, which is culturally specific to certain countries in Africa. You know, there's just so many myths out there. And yeah, I think we would do well to do our homework and realize that it's not as blanketed kind of victim mentality as people think.
Have you read, this just was translated into English this year, I think. It's called I'm Writing You from Tehran.
I haven't read that, no.
It's nonfiction. The author is Delphine Minuit. Mm-hmm. So she's French-Iranian. And goes back to Tehran to visit her grandmother. Her grandfather has passed away. And I believe it's in the 90s. And so there's a lot of, again, political unrest happening. And she ends up fleeing in the middle of the night after living there a couple of years. And it's one of those where I read it and realized this is a much more modern country than anyone talks about.
True, true, true. Preach. It truly is. And honestly, I tried to show so much of that in my first book, In Together Tea. That's also set in the 90s, and then it goes back in time to the 70s. But I just can't even tell you how different it is from the perception people have of it, and how different the women are from the perception people have of them. I read somewhere there was a study done about visits to other countries, and the gap between what people's expectations were and what their actual experience was. And the country with the biggest gap, with the largest gap between expectations and reality, was Iran.
Yeah.
Because people visiting go in with this expectation, and then they see that it is actually not at all how it's portrayed in so much of our media.
Yeah.
It's actually very vibrant and colorful and cosmopolitan and modern,
yes.
Even after the revolution.
Yes. And it was even modern in 1953. I mean, that's...
Yes, yes.
Modernity is not new to Iran, right? So yeah. One of the scenes that I really appreciated that really drew me to Roya and Bahman were they would go on dates to this cafe, and it was where Roya tasted espresso, I think, for the first time. Yeah. And it was just, there was something so sweet and so current about it, even though this was taking place in 1953. And I just felt really connected to the characters then. And so I think that brings us full circle that this book is brilliant. It is one of those windows into another culture that makes the world smaller.
Mm.
And it's a beautifully told, unrequited love story. And I thank you so much for writing it and for talking about kind of the feminist implications of it too. I think that was a really interesting angle. So thank you for that. I have two final questions.
Yeah.
The first is, if you have a book to recommend to our listeners that is not your own, what would you recommend?
Yeah, you know, I finished reading a book. It's called The 7 or 8 Deaths of Stella Fortuna. I don't know if you've read it.
Uh-uh.
It's a novel by Juliet Grahams. It takes place mostly in a working class family who live in Italy. Like that's the main setting is Italy, and the family's working class Italian. And then later they do come to the US. It has so many feminist themes. Basically, this expectation that women's fulfillment comes from marriage and having children. But usually in the book, when that's addressed, the antidote to that is to be single and sexual and have a lot of fun, right? As a bachelorette or whatever. But it also deals with asexuality. Like, what if that's not what you want either? So I think it's just very well done, and I highly recommend it.
That sounds excellent. I lived in Italy, so I'm always drawn to books that have a little bit of an Italian flavor to it. So, oh, that sounds great. I'm going to look that up right away. Yeah. And my final question is, where can we find you online if we want to connect with you?
Oh, sure. So my website is basically myname.com. So MarjanKamali.com. I'm on Twitter @MarjanKamali. Instagram is MarjanKamali7, I believe. There's another one of me in Iran. You can also follow her. It's not me. And yeah, Oh, and of course, my Facebook author page again, just my name.
Great.
So I'm out there. And you know what? The thing I get asked the most about online on social media are recipes for the food.
Oh, I have that written down as a topic we could have hit. There are the food in this book is just, I wanted to eat it all. It is so, chef's kiss. It is just so brilliantly described. I felt like I could smell it. It's beautiful. So if you're a food lover in books, this is definitely a book to pick up too.
Yeah, I link to recipes a lot because people ask. So, you know.
Good. I'm going to have to track down some of those recipes. So thank you for that. All right. We will link all of your social media in the show notes, as well as your book and your book recommendation. And that's it, I suppose. Thank you so much for this. This has been so delightful.
Thank you so much. This was so much fun. And I love discussing everything that been on my mind and in my heart. So thank you. Thank you for your great question. I'm sorry you cried on the plane, but I'm kind of glad you did too.
Yeah, I'm not sorry about it at all. Take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to today's show. As always, a rating and review in the podcast app of your choice goes a long way in supporting feminist media. We'd love to have you join the Feminist Book Club subscription box, a community-driven subscription box which features a book of the month and products from women and queer-owned businesses delivered directly to your doorstep. This is an easy way to vote with your dollars, as you'll be supporting this podcast, small women and queer-owned businesses, and the charity beneficiary of the month, which receives 5% of total sales. Use code PODCAST for a discount on any subscription package. Learn more about the box and get the show notes for today's episode at feministbookclub.com. See you next time.
A well-read woman is a dangerous creature. Oh, 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 oh. A well-read woman is a dangerous creature. Oh,
oh, oh. Ever tried reading while jogging, cooking, or even juggling flaming torches? Yeah, doesn't end well. But with audiobooks.com, you can conquer books without the circus act. Dive into over 450,000 titles, including more than 10,000 free ones. Get hooked on a bestseller, find your next obsession, or finally read that classic you've been avoiding since high school. And here's the inside scoop. Sign up today for a free 30-day trial and snag your first three audiobooks on the house. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.